decades, the duo have made it their mission to perform the music they love, a blend of bluegrass, folk, old-time, and acoustic country. Robin and Linda sang Americana before it was cool. The show is Friday, March 13th at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church in Southeast Portland, Oregon. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Arnica String Quartet and Peter Zisa on Saturday, March 7th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Community Music Center in Portland. The Arnica String Quartet, joined by Peter Zisa, brings you a celebration of Beethoven and the triumph of the human spirit through adversity and isolation. Again, that's the Arnica String Quartet and Peter Zisa on Saturday, March 7th, from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Community Music Center, 3350 Southeast Francis Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown vows to take executive action on climate change following the failure of cap and trade in the legislature.
Coronavirus closes universities in Washington, though most still have faith in the CDC.
And the Attorney General Barr is rebuked by a federal judge for his handling of the Mueller report.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 6th, 2020. I'm Jeffrey Wade.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. Governor Kate Brown announced Thursday that she will be taking executive action to lower greenhouse gases, addressing topics covered in the polarizing cap-and-trade bill. Brown said she preferred legislative process to tackle effects of climate change in hopes of providing resources and flexibility to businesses and communities, but that she would not back down and will be moving forward with executive action to lower greenhouse gas emissions. Senate Bill 1530 would put a cap on statewide carbon emissions with an intent to lower that number over time, also requiring industrial sectors to purchase allowances to offset them. Republicans walked out of the session on February 24th after a Senate committee vote on the bill, thus stalling the legislative process. Democratic leaders on the Senate adjourned the 2020 session early as a result of the walkout. Brown's statement also said she is open to calling a special session if it would be of benefit to Oregonians.
A new survey finds that regardless of their political beliefs, people trust the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and doctors most during the coronavirus outbreak. KBOO's Daniel Conway has more.
Despite these politically divided times, Americans are still ready to listen to health officials during the coronavirus epidemic. That's according to a February survey from the University of Oregon, which finds trust is high in doctors and in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Ellen Peters, director of the Center for Science Communication Research at UO, says respondents' politics predicted their trust in politicians, but not health officials.
Even among conservatives, President Trump was not the most trusted. It turns out that among conservatives and liberals alike, the most trusted were the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as people's doctors.
The survey says 80% of people who identified as conservative and 75% of liberals said they trust the CDC to reduce the risk of the coronavirus outbreak. Similarly, 80% of conservatives and 77% of liberals have faith in their doctors. In Oregon, there are 3 confirmed cases of novel coronavirus, according to authorities. The survey also found people trust their own ability to reduce their personal risk, but Peters notes that folks still need accurate information they can act on.
If they get these messages from trusted sources, that's likely to have more impact on them. They're going to be more likely to follow those recommendations of the proper techniques to be using to do things like wash your hands, cover your coughs and sneezes, etc.
In the past week, the Trump administration said it will tighten control over health officials' messaging on coronavirus. Peter says it isn't clear how that will affect trustworthiness, but it could slow news at a time when information needs to be released quickly. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Daniel Conway.
With rising numbers of coronavirus being confirmed in Washington, universities have announced changes in their curriculum. Events have been postponed, and Seattle begins vaccine testing. As of Friday morning, the number of coronavirus or COVID-19 cases has risen to 79 across four counties. The Department of Health announced in an update at 11 a.m. that 58 cases were confirmed in King County, 19 cases in Snohomish County, and one case in both Grant and Jefferson County. 11 deaths have been reported due to the outbreak. The University of Washington and Seattle University stated that starting Monday, classes will no longer be meeting in person through the end of winter term, relying on online curriculum for the remaining duration. Emerald City Comic-Con has been canceled for its original mid-March date and postponed until summer. Vaccine testing has been launched by Kaiser Permanente in Seattle and is seeking healthy adults for the initial trial. Multiple schools have been temporarily closed for deep cleaning after potential COVID-19 exposures. Despite public concerns, Washington health officials maintain there is not widespread transmission locally.
Jeremy Christian is scheduled to be sentenced on March 27th for the fatal stabbings of two men and serious injury to a third aboard a MAX train in May 2017. After 15 days of trial in February, jurors found Christian guilty of 12 crimes, including first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, and multiple hate crimes. Christian could be sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of release, known as true life, or life in prison with a 30-year minimum. Oregon passed its new first-degree murder law, Senate Bill 1013, last summer, which gives Multnomah County Judge Cheryl Albrecht both options when it comes to Christian's sentence. Christian's defense attorneys are arguing that the new law is unconstitutional and that the judge could only seek the second option, which could require another hearing to debate the issue. Even if Judge Albrecht agrees with the defense attorneys, prosecutors could argue that she can rule Christian to consecutive sentences, 30 years for each murder and 7.5 for attempted murder, with possibly more time for the other crimes he was found guilty of. In addition to the murder charges, Christian was found guilty on charges of assault, intimidation, unlawful use of a weapon, and menacing. The judge's decision will be reached on March 27th at 9 a.m. at the Multnomah County Courthouse.
The city of Portland withdrew the legal claim that Quanis Hayes' death at the hands of police was the fault of his mother. The case against the police for fatal shooting of Quanis Hayes drew immense criticism when city attorneys enacted a defense that pinned the responsibility of the death on Hayes' mother. Candidates for city office, including Sarah Iorone and Carmen Rubio, Loretta Smith, and Sam Adams, drafted a letter to city council last week condemning the city's defense strategy against the wrongful death lawsuit filed by the Hayes family. The now rescinded argument claimed that since Hayes' mother had known that her son had been acting out prior to the shooting, that she was responsible for being more in control of her son and was thus responsible for the outcome of the incident with the Portland police. Teen Quanis Hayes was killed by police in 2017. Hayes was a suspect in an armed robbery earlier that morning, and when tracked down by officers, was told commands. Hayes moved his hands near his waistband. He was then shot by Hurst in the head, ribs, and torso. An airsoft pistol was found in a flower bed near his body, but no fingerprints were ever entered into evidence. The lawsuit by the family alleges that Hayes was given commands that contradicted themselves, and then the officers never saw a firearm on Hayes, which Officer Hurst has testified to be true.
Four Portland housing projects got some good news on Thursday, with the state awarding them grants to help build affordable renting housing units. $16 million in grants will be combined with state and federal tax credits, along with other state and private housing funds, to allow the creation of 351 subsidized apartments and tiny houses. The largest project receiving funding is Portland's River Place 2 in the South Waterfront neighborhood, which will have 178 units. The River Place 2 apartments are expected to be completed by January 2022. 115th and Division Street apartments will have 138 units made available, ranging from studios to three-bedroom apartments, also predicted to open January 2022. Portsmouth Commons, a project by the Portsmouth Union Church, is set to construct 20 units in their North Lombard Street property, primarily aimed at serving homeless veterans. The Douglas Fir Apartments at 6485 Southwest 128th Avenue are expected to have 15 units that serve veterans, Native Americans, and low-income renters with severe mental illness. Other funded projects include retaining and rehabbing units across the state at Village at Washington Square in Tigard, and building complexes in Medford, Dallas, Klamath Falls, Toledo, and LeGrand.
It's in process. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with rain showers and a low of 39. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with occasional rain showers and a high near 50 degrees. Today in history, in 1957, Ghana became the first sub-Saharan country to gain independence from British rule. The quote of the day is from former Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who said, quote, "If I were dying, my last words would be, have faith and pursue the unknown end."
Senator Elizabeth Warren dropped her bid for the Democratic nomination for president, but some people in states that vote next Tuesday have already cast a ballot for her by mail or absentee. In Michigan, voters are given the option to spoil their ballot, have it destroyed, and replaced by their local clerk's office. With that story and more, here's Lily Boakley with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
Not today. Not today. I need some space around this and want to take a little time to think a little more.
Senator Elizabeth Warren declined to endorse anyone when ending her bid for the nomination, surrounded by reporters and shuttering cameras. It's now essentially a two-person race between Senator Bernie Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden.
I was told at the beginning of this whole undertaking that there are two lanes. A progressive lane that Bernie Sanders is the incumbent for, and a moderate lane that Joe Biden is the incumbent for. And there's no room for anyone else in this. I thought that wasn't right, but evidently I was wrong.
Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard's technically still in it, but in very distant third place, with just two delegates so far from American Samoa. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer endorsed Biden yesterday ahead of next Tuesday's primary. Washington, Mississippi, Idaho, Missouri, and North Dakota will also vote then, though many voters have already cast mail-in absentee ballots. In Michigan, it's possible to, quote, spoil, unquote, a ballot that's already been mailed in by asking a county clerk to destroy and replace it by Monday next week at 4 p.m. Five candidates dropped out this week alone, and so far there have been almost 16,000 requests to spoil. Ben Dulfraser, a voter from Detroit, sent in his ballot for Warren, but he's in California for work right now, so spoiling it would be a challenge.
When I took my vote, I did it right after the Nevada debate where Warren just dismantled Bloomberg and sent him packing. And I thought, okay, here it is. If we're going to get a surge, I'm putting my ballot in. I feel good about it. Forget it. And I'm happy with it. If I still had my ballot, I would vote for Bernie because, you know, sometimes the head has to beat the heart. But I made my decision back when it wasn't so clear.
Spoiling absentee ballots isn't new, but Progress Michigan's executive director Lonnie Scott explained what is new.
We have all sorts of new voting laws in Michigan, thanks to an initiative that passed in 2018 that really opens up our voting laws to make sure that everyone has access to go out and cast their vote.
Michigan residents can now register day of by going to their local clerk's office before heading to the polls. And any voter can request an absentee ballot. Previously, folks needed a reason: age, health, work demands, or being a college student or overseas service member. Michigan State Department's Jake Rollo says absentee requests are up 80% from last cycle, but he hesitates to predict a higher total turnout.
There's no way for us to really break that down. It's quite likely that many of the people who have requested absentee ballots this year in 2016 voted at the polls on election day. You know, this is a new right, and so lots of people are exercising that right. They understand that it's easier and in some ways more comfortable to just vote at home on your couch where you can think through the candidates and, you know, figure out what you want to do.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A federal judge sharply criticized Attorney General William Barr in a ruling Thursday, saying Barr's public summary of the Mueller report didn't match special counsel's actual conclusions. Judge Reggie B. Walton denounced Barr's actions, suggesting he had made a calculated attempt to help President Donald Trump, and said the Attorney General had, quote, a lack of candor, end quote, with the public and Congress. In his ruling, Judge Walton said Barr could not be trusted, saying the sitting Attorney General had so deceived the American people that he could not trust assertions made by the Justice Department under Barr's control. The decision focuses on the period last spring between the delivery of a 381-page Mueller report to the Attorney General, Barr's 4-page public summary of the report, and the release of the report itself a month later, which revealed several discrepancies between documents. Judge Walton cited the scope of links that investigators found between the Trump campaign and Russia. Episodes meeting the criteria for obstruction of justice were grossly obfuscated by Barr. Judge Walton requested an unredacted copy of the report to ensure any omissions were not self-serving or tainted, saying, quote, adherence to the Freedom of Information Act's objective of keeping the American public informed of what its government is up to demands nothing less, end quote. We'll expect to hear more from Judge Walton in the near future.
The Canadian Supreme Court declined to hear challenges to the construction of the Trans Mountain Pipeline from Indigenous groups. The groups have challenged the pipeline in court and physically by creating blockades and protests in several provinces. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonio Gonzalez. The Supreme Court of Canada has decided not to hear challenges from Indigenous and environmental groups on the Trans Mountain Pipeline, the Canadian Press reports. This clears another hurdle for the proposed multi-billion dollar pipeline expansion in Western Canada. Several Native groups in British Columbia argued they were not properly consulted and that the federal government had already decided to approve the project before any consultations in 2018 and 2019. Last month, an appeals court ruled the government made a genuine effort to listen to and consider issues raised by First Nations. Native leaders following the ruling vowed to fight. Supporters of the project, including federal and provincial government leaders, say the project has already gone through years of reviews and Indigenous consultation and point to other Native groups supporting the project. The pipeline expansion would increase the amount of Alberta oil piped to the West Coast. On Thursday, Mohawks of Ganawake took down their rail blockade near Montreal, APTN reports. The demonstration lasted for nearly a month in support of Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs opposing a natural gas pipeline project in northern British Columbia. Demonstrations and blockades have popped up across Canada in recent weeks in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en. A tentative agreement was reached last weekend between hereditary chiefs and government leaders. Mohawk demonstrators say their action is in good faith to help alleviate pressure and leave room for the Wet'suwet'en people to consider the proposal by Canada and British Columbia. The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is urging the White House to ensure there are resources for tribes to respond to the coronavirus. The committee, with the support of 27 senators, sent a letter Thursday to Vice President Pence requesting the administration hold meaningful engagement with tribes. The letter followed the congressional passage of a coronavirus emergency spending bill. The bill includes $40 million for tribes, tribal organizations, and urban Indian organizations. President Trump has signed the spending package. Meanwhile, the administration held a tribal conference call Thursday to provide updates on the coronavirus. Tribes across the country are working on preparedness and addressing precautions to their communities. A bill passed the Washington State Senate that will allow Native American students to wear tribal regalia during their high school or higher education graduation ceremonies. Steve Jackson reports.
Currently, tribal members can ask for permission from a school district to wear traditional tribal garb, but the waiver process often takes a long time. Senator Andy Billig of Spokane said the concept for the bill was brought to him by a local Spokane tribal member.
And it was brought to me by a constituent, Jamie Sijon, and just appreciate so much her advocacy on this issue. She's a member of the Spokane tribe, and she had been hearing from people around the state about this issue. And she started doing some research and came to me and said, North Dakota has this law, South Dakota has this law, Montana, California, and other states, and Washington State should as well. It's appropriate, it's respectful, and I urge your support. Thank you.
There was only one vote against the measure in the Senate. The bill has already passed the House and now goes to Washington Governor Jay Inslee for his signature. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
An Indian mascot bill in Illinois passed out of an education committee this week. The bill requires schools with Native American mascots or logos to get approval from a tribe. It also requires schools to teach about Native culture and contributions. The bill was introduced last month as some schools in the state are reportedly considering retiring their Indian mascots. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Oregon is another supermoon on Monday, March 9th. The moon's maximum point will happen at 10:47 a.m. A supermoon occurs when the moon is in its closest approach to the Earth in its cycle. This will be a full supermoon, which means the moon will also be full in the sky when the event happens. The moon on Monday will be about 14% bigger and 30% brighter than normal. If you happen to miss this one, there'll be another supermoon next month on April the 7th.
Joining Linda and I in the studio today are Camillo and Lloyd, who are volunteers with BARC. BARC is a group dedicated to preserving forests, especially on Mount Hood, and that often means pushing back against the Forest Service on proposed timber sales, which they do in a few different ways, which we'll be getting to in a bit. But first, welcome, Camillo and Lloyd.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here in the KBOO studios. Last time we were here, we were talking about the Zigzag Timber Sale. Can you tell us what the status of that sale is? And there was a public comment period happening, and you were encouraging people to submit commentary in opposition to the sale. What can you tell us is going on now?
Lloyd? Thanks for asking. So we're still in the first stage. The comment period is on, and what we now do is wait for a response from the Forest Service. And then we will evaluate that response, and we'll answer specifics they give us back, depending on what the information we gave them. But we're still looking for people to get involved at this time, so it's still the first stage.
If people want to comment on the Zigzag Timber Sale and they want to learn what you have to say about it, can they find all the information they need at your website?
Yeah, absolutely.
What is that?
bark-out.org, barkout.org, and it's chock full of information on everything we do. So you can go there and find information.
And links to making comments so that you can...
Links to making comments. And also in the next 6 weeks, we are going to have lots of meetings at BARC on different aspects of that and the forest plan.
So this is a place someone could jump in right now and get active.
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
There's a group that meets regularly to do strategy planning, and we're inviting everybody to get involved with that. So if you go to the website... Look for the post on the Zigzag Sale or on the forest plan, and there'll be an indication when the strategy meetings are held.
Okay, great. That's great that people can jump in and be part of that conversation. Now, I understand that the Forest Service recently recovered from the sale or removed from sale 961 acres in the Wacoma timber sale and a few hundred in the grasshopper timber sales. These are the areas that coincided where BARC volunteers ground truthed, what we call ground truthed, during a campout. So was that a victory for you guys? Is that congratulations to you?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because we basically, when we go to the Forest Service for information, with our information, our ground truthing, I mean, we look forward to them just canceling a timber sale. But sometimes what we accept is them you know, removing certain parcels.
So you look and see what's actually there on the ground, and if it doesn't match what they've said,
absolutely,
and there's more damage to the environment going to be caused, then you can actually save that part of the forest by having documented it.
I believe the withdrawal of those 900 acres may have been the result of a suit that was filed. And I want to bring everybody's attention to something that's going on now that's really critical and urgent. It's critical because if we don't do something about it, they will take away our right to supervise or to contribute to how the forest plan is made and how every project that goes in the federal project that goes on there could be disallowed from having an opportunity to have input through the National Environmental Policy Act. They're trying to revise it so that it takes away our privilege to make comments. And I would urge you to go to the website now because the comment period is up on March 10th. Go there and check that out and make a comment saying that you want to preserve those rights.
So if they went to it would be to the BARC website to find the link.
Yes.
What would the title or what would they be looking for there?
It's the change in the NEPA plan, National Environmental Policy Act.
Okay, great.
All right, those dates are coming up. Now, BARC promotes an idea that forest defense is climate defense. Can you break that down for us?
Yes, well, one of the big issues now is that there is a Mount Hood forest plan, which was devised in 1994. It hasn't been updated in 15 years, and that sets a lot of the protocols for how the Forest Service scopes land for timber sales. And it's important to tell people that the main business of the Forest Service is timber sales. Recreation and conservation are woven through, but that's not their business. It's the Department of Agriculture. So when you go back to that forest plan that hasn't been updated in 15 years, there's been incredible changes, first with climate disruption, also with new science, which talks about carbon sequestration by our forests, which is really important in reducing carbon emissions. The Forest Service, it's shocking to see, but they do not have to address those issues because of the protocols in this Mount Hood forest plan. So one of the big initiatives with BARC now is we would like to have it completely revised, but basically the protocols as they've been set up by the government is it's easier to go and try to amend it point by point. So we could do a big issue that the Forest Service maybe agrees with us on is fire management. So we might go look for an amendment on that. But even with climate disruption and carbon sequestration, changes in hydrology because of climate change, all of these things can be amended, but ultimately they're in the hands of the supervisor of the National Forest. However, of course, we still have the right for public comment, for ground truthing, and
Are they looking for amending that forest plan at any time? Is the Forest Service planning on amending it, or is it just they're happy to go forward with an antiquated plan?
Well, I think that we will have an opportunity to make an amendment to the plan, but we will have to make that clear. One thing I wanted to add in response to the last question about forest defense is climate defense. The timber industry is the primary contributor to carbon in the state. 35% of all emissions is from forest activity.
I didn't realize that.
And if we were to preserve forests, we could practically neutralize that.
And the state of Oregon actually recognizes that science now.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up now.
We've been speaking with Camilla and Lloyd, two volunteers with the nonprofit forest advocacy group BARC. More information about BARC can be found on their website at bark-out.org.
And thank you both for joining us today in the KBOO studios. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 6, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade and Daniel Conway. The producer is Althea Billings. Our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonio Gonzalez, Lily Boakley, and Eric Tegetoff. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jeffrey Wade.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. And coming up on tonight, first is Counterspin, followed by The Struggle.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, coronavirus is above all a health story, of course, but healthcare plays out within societies, with economic structures and policies that have a lot to do with whether people get sick and whether they get care, and where overall impacts are felt. We'll talk with Josh Bivens, Research Director at Economic Policy.